She thinks it's out of her comfort zone. hi, everybody. Due to the grace of a loving God that I didn't even believe in when I first got here, just enough willingness and open-mindedness and honesty, good sponsorship, both sides, and the 12 amazing steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not had a drink or drug since October 16th, 1975. And for that, I am... You know, it's funny, when I had my 10th anniversary, of course, the first, we all know that one is the most important and the biggest, and it's, you know, like the world stops. But I had my 10th anniversary, and my husband gave me a big party. I had my 20th anniversary, and my husband gave me a big party. I had my 30th anniversary. I gave me a big party. And you know, when I hit 40, I knew I wasn't doing it. I knew I couldn't do it. I knew I cannot stay sober. I can't stay sober one day, much less 40 years. There's no way that this has been an arena thing, you know? And the gratitude and the feeling of awe about this program that not only saved my life, but so many millions of other lives, just overcame me. And the other thing that overcame me when I was 40 was not only the awesomeness of the fact that I know I can't do this, but the fact that one day at a time I can. Isn't it funny how it goes that this program is, it's so simple and it's so complicated. It's just amazing. I love it. I did not come here loving it, but that's another story. I've related to everybody this weekend, all the speakers have done an awesome job. I relate to everybody I've talked to. I've had more fun getting to know people individually. That's one of the fun of these conferences, is meeting people that you don't know and getting to know them. I'm looking at some of them now, you know. And, you know, I think Alcoholics Anonymous is the only organization I know of where we relate because of our brokenness. You know, it's the pain that we all grow up with and feel, the feeling of not belonging, the feeling of being left out. You know, in my own family, I didn't feel like I belonged. I was pretty sure I was adopted. And but that god-awful feeling of separateness that we all have is what unites us in sobriety, because we're doing something about it and we're overcoming it. And with God's grace, we are able to live happy and useful lives. That blows me away, you know. I come from a family that pretty dysfunctional. They were fear-based. Well, my mother was, and I'm talking about me. I was. I was born during World War II, and my father was a Navy pilot, and we moved all the time. I never spent one year in one school, and was always traveling with my father, my mother, and my sister, and my little brother. And I look back now and I see my sister looked forward to these moves. She was going to meet new friends, have the best time. She loved it. And I learned early on to read. Reading was my first addiction. I felt comfortable and safe in a book. I had a feeling of control in a book. I had no feeling of control in my life, none. And I guess that's just par for the course for an alcoholic, this need to control things, this, their environment. But, you know, it didn't hit me at the time, but afterwards, thinking about it, it just seems so bizarre that two little girls, being raised in the same family, could have such entirely different outlooks on life. My parents were both alcoholics, but I was 3 years sober before I realized that my mother was an alcoholic, because she was always drinking socially acceptably, even the socially acceptable drinks, not the hot scotch out of the bottle that I did, you know. Who needs a glass, right? It does a job without it. And my father was an obvious alcoholic. I'm amazed, he really rose in the ranks in the Navy, and it blows me away. The progression in him never did really hit to the point where he was powerless. He died with a wet brain at the age of 81. I'm hoping I'd take after him without the wet brain, you know. When I forget stuff a lot, I really wonder about it. But he was the kind of alcoholic that would drink and get rageful. He never was physically abusive, but emotionally and verbally extremely abusive. And I'm not one of those kind of kids that would just sort of lay back, you know. I stood toe-to-toe. I still do that. You know, I'm a rebel and always have been, and I would stand toe-to-toe and get shouted at and then somehow feel like I'd won. And I don't know what that's about, but, you know, in a way I did, because I didn't give in. So you can imagine how difficult it was for me to get sober and to surrender. I really think that a lot of my sobriety is just a series of surrenders. You know, the big one, when we finally get sober, that was the biggest for me. But at any rate, going back to growing up, we lived in Japan for a while, right after World War II, and of course, during all this period of time, I'd been told that the Japanese ate little kids, and my parents entertained a lot, and they were gone a lot in Japan, and I was left with about 25 Japanese servants, me and my sister, and I was terrified. And when I look back, I could not face that terror. That's why I read, you know, because I'd go back in a book totally devoid of feelings. I had no feelings at all except anger, just like my dad. And I could relate to that. And that was a safe feeling, but fear was not. But I was so fear-based. And I think a lot of that fear comes from the fact that we're so self-centered and I was totally self-obsessed. You know, it was all about me. I mean, I was in Japan after the war, and, you know, it was me. And I was that way my whole life, you know. It was all about me, and I get to choose whether I participate or not, and mainly I chose not to. I always had the feeling that everybody knew how to do life, and I didn't. I don't know where I got this feeling, but I would look at my cousins, and they were so self-assured, and they did all this good stuff, and everybody I knew and my classmates. And I didn't realize till I got sober that I was comparing their outsides with my insides. I don't know, looking at this room now, you all look like everything's fine, you're healthy, you know, everything's going good. You're totally self-assured and, you know, and you've got life, you know, control, etc. And I know on the inside, you all are just like me. Every one of you in this room is just like me. And we do the best we can. And I remember going to a meeting when I first got sober, going to a meeting and nobody said anything to me, and I had moved when I was 3 weeks sober. You'll hear about that. And walked into a meeting that was huge. It had like, I don't know, 100 people in it. No one said anything to me. They didn't say, well, do you know where the coffee is? I was obviously new and my feelings were hurt. And I kept doing this for a couple of times, and I finally decided, well, they can't keep me out. You know, I thought you were trying to get rid of me. And because obviously I didn't belong, I didn't fit in, you know how that goes in AA. And so I remember saying to myself, I wonder what would happen if I went over to somebody that I had seen at a meeting previously and just said hello. Wonder what would happen. And this thought occurred, well, I don't think they'd pull out a gun and shoot me because I've never seen that. And I was serious. So I decided I would do that, and I walked over to this girl that I had seen at meetings before, and I said hi, and I found out something wonderful. Conversation is two-way. You know, I talk, you talk. It's like a dance. And I thought, this is fantastic. I can do this because I can do my part. I don't have to do your part. And that was the beginning of the end of isolation for me, this one woman that I saw not too long ago in Fort Lauderdale where I got sober, and I had not seen her for 30 years. And it was just, she has no idea how much meaning she has in my life. You know how it is with people that we run into that have such meaning for us, and they never know it, and they don't need to. You know, that's because I know it, and that's what's important. But getting back to family, so I was growing up in this little family. My brother died of drowning when he was 5, and my sister died of a brain tumor when she was 13, and the black sheep was left. You know, I was the one that was left, and I felt so guilty about it. And my mother was extremely withdrawn anyway, and my brother's death just did her in. Looking at it now, it's really cool. You know, one of the things I learned about the fourth step is I take a walk from the prosecution table around to the defense table and take a look. And it's a whole different picture. I look at my parents now from an entirely different viewpoint. I look at my mother who lost two children, and one of them, my brother, died because she neglected to tell him that he could come with us. He walked out on the beach where we lived and got caught in an undertow. And she, her guilt must have been just horrendous. No wonder she drank. And never talked about it. When my brother died, we never mentioned his name again. When my sister died, same thing. Never mentioned her name again. It was a very closed-off family. We didn't talk about feelings. You know, we'd talk about the weather. We'd talk about this, that, and the other thing, especially people that weren't there. And, you know, this was acceptable kind of conversation. So I grew up thinking that the feelings that I had of fear and anxiety and not belonging and all that, I thought I was wrong to have those, because looking around this room to this minute, I still don't see you all having feelings, you know? So once again, looking at the outside, comparing it with my insides. So I shut down completely and read. And if I'd found booze when I was about six, I'll tell you what, you'd have me in here by about 12, you know, because alcohol turned out to do a much more efficient job than books. At any rate, so we moved and moved and moved, and I grew up, long story short, I ended up trading in the books for boys at about 13 or 14, and I found that I always had, looking back, my life is all hindsight. You know, I don't have any now sight and absolutely no foresight, but I have a huge amount of hindsight. And looking back, I can see that I was always escaping. I was always looking for some peace on the outside and to come from the outside. I was looking for that comfort, ease and comfort that alcohol gave us, but I was looking at it to come from the outside, just like from a scotch bottle, right? And I got it from books. And then I started dating and found that, wow, this is really cool, you know. I could get this great, big, handsome man, and I could kind of put him out here in front of me and say, look what I can do. You know, I'm not so bad. And I was so, you know, unfortunately, I ended up getting pregnant. And getting pregnant in the times I got pregnant was not a big deal. It was a horrible, horrible big deal. It was a terrible disgrace. My parents sent me away to live with the family, thank God. And I ended up, you know, just feeling full of shame. I was already a shame-based person, and I really felt shame-based then. I mean, shame was just awful. And the problem with that was I ended up marrying her father, and we had a very brief marriage. It turns out that he was kind of physically violent, and I'd put up with my father's stuff, but I wasn't putting up with that. Somewhere I got the insight that this was not going to stop. He hit me one time and apologized, I'm never going to happen again and all this. And I knew that that was not going to be the truth. I knew something worse was going to happen. And 3 weeks later, I was divorced. And, in the process. And so there was my little girl and me. And he was in college in Berkeley, California, at the University of California, and he graduated and went to graduate school in Hawaii. And it was right at that period of time that we split. And so he went and I stayed. And his mother asked if she could take my daughter over to Hawaii for Christmas vacation. And I said, sure. And here's the problem. I never asked for her back. I was busy with a new boyfriend and new life, and being 20, I think I was about 17 when I got pregnant, and so this was about, I was about 19 or 20, and I had a new life, and life was good. And so one of the things that I had the hardest time dealing with when I got sober was the fact that my daughter was not raised by me. She was raised by her grandmother, and ended up, you know, having a stable home, going to school, having clean clothes, not having booze in the house, you know, kind of stuff. She had a, quote, normal life. And I felt so guilty that nobody, I never even told anybody I had a daughter until I was in the program and did my first fourth and fifth step. It was like she didn't exist. I didn't see her from the time she was 2 until the time she was 13. And at that point, my mother was dying of cancer. And somehow God has, looking back, hindsight, God has intervened in my life in a way to help other people, you know, to deal with their stuff. And somewhere I got this idea that the only thing that would make my mother happy as she was dying was to see me and Nina together. So Nina was living in San Francisco with her grandmother, and I flew up there and got her and brought her back. And my mother was happy, and she saw us together, and I felt really good about that. It also reacquainted me with Nina, and we started a relationship, which today is as best as it can be. She's an active alcoholic. She's been in and out of AA. She's able to manage it somehow. Her job is very important to her, so she manages her alcoholism around the job, and I could never do that. I just, once I started drinking, I continued, period. I had my first drink when I was with this man that superseded the husband, and I was nervous, and he said, "Would you like a Manhattan?" And I said, "Yes." And I hadn't had a drink up until then because instinctively, I looked at my parents, and I didn't want that. You know, I certainly didn't want to be like my father. And so I had never had a drink of alcohol, except the kind where, you know, parents give kids a drink, and they think that's cute when they go, ew, and all that. And so I'd had that kind of drink. But this was a drink out of fear. And, oh, my God, as all of you in this room know that are alcoholic, that changed the world. All of a sudden, I had power. I had no power before this, but all of a sudden I had power in my life, and I was no longer scared. I was no longer, it gave me all the ammunition I needed to lead a happy life. And I decided that night I was going to stay in that world as much as I could. And I used to think reading was good. Oh, for pity's sakes. You know, it made reading and boys paled in comparison to booze. And looking back, I see that I never had a drink. I got drunk every time I had a drink. My drinking, I can see the progression. I had a fairly short career, about 10 years. And when it was over, it was over. By the time I had my first drink sitting at a nice restaurant in a nice dress with a nice man, I had my last drink in a nightgown that I'd been wearing for 3 years, going in and out of hospitals, drinking around the clock, going into convulsions, and still drinking, and my whole life was alcohol. It was a very, very small life. It was not even a life. And I was just like it says in the big book, I was at the jumping off place. I was too egotistical to kill myself. I had to know who would come to my funeral. And I just, you know. But the progression downhill for me is a hill. It just goes straight down. And what I did in between the first drink and the last drink was pretty much the same thing that everybody else does that's alcoholic. I had a little life, you know. I traveled a lot. I was lucky. I call myself a low-bottom drunk with an income. I had a little income from my grandmother who figured I was not going to do well, I guess. So she fixed it so that I, you know, was okay, just barely. And so I traveled a lot, and I drank a lot. And that was kind of my life. And it got worse and it worse and worse. I love that thing in the big book about gradually it got worse. Bill's story just gets to me. Every time I read it, it hits me because it's me. The progression downhill from the early drinking until the last gasp is so horrible. And because I feel the despair. You know, I was in such despair. I couldn't see life with alcohol. I couldn't see life without it. I had tried every way I could think of to control it. I'd never, ever, well, towards the end, it got to the point where I'd put myself in a hospital thinking I didn't feel well. What really was, I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop. And I'd put myself in a hospital, and I'd make myself learn to eat again because I didn't eat when I was drinking. And I would come out thinking, I got it now. I know what to do. You know, I got to eat when I drink, because I didn't. So that would work for maybe 2 days, you know, and then to hell with the food. Give me the booze. And, excuse me. And, you know, when I think of my drinking now, even when I look back at that, I lived in San Francisco, I was running around North Beach, I had the best time, blah, blah, blah. And all I see when I look back is the alcoholism, you know, the reasons I was drinking and the repercussions from drinking. You know, I went to college and got straight A's because I was so inferior, I had to do better than anybody else, right? So my drinking is such a symptom of what's wrong with me. And I got to AA. I went to one AA meeting. 3 years later, I got sober. I went to one AA meeting in Dallas, Texas, and thought, isn't that nice? They have a place to go. Of course, I was drunk. I know I kept everybody in that room sober that night because I was a mess. And I did not go back to AA for 3 years. I was doing it on my own, thank you, managing my drinking. And it finally got down to the point where I had this vision one night where I was in between hospitals. I was drinking, and I had this vision. I was in my 30s, and I could see myself living that way for the next 40 years. I could not go on another minute. You know how we reach that point where it's over, kids, it's over. And I called AA. That one meeting that I went to, thank God for it. You know, those people welcomed me no matter what I looked like or sounded like or how I smelled, because I know I did smell bad. And thank God for that meeting, because it, when the time came to do something really, to really surrender, I came to AA, I came to you all. And I stayed sober and kind of around AA for about a month. I went to meetings. I didn't get a sponsor. I took a look at the big book, and I thought, shoot, I've read better books than that, you know. And I'm an English major, so I looked at some of it and thought, geez, the writing is so poor. You know, I could do better than that, too. And but I went, and finally I decided one day that the reason that I couldn't drink successfully was that I wasn't having fun the last part of my drinking. I wasn't having fun. So I was going to have fun. Now, I want you to know I had married a man to go to the liquor store for me, and because I was afraid to drive. I wasn't afraid of DUI. I was terrified of hitting someone. I knew I couldn't live with that. And so I'd married this guy who, he drank beer, I drank scotch, perfect marriage. And he went to the liquor store for me. And so he was out of town, and I had my drinking for, I drank for 5 days. Not any fun, folks. I got news. I was wrong. And I decided at the end of it that, you know, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I can't drink even for fun. And the phone rang, and I never answered the phone, but I did that day. And it was a woman I'd never met. She'd gotten my number by mistake. She had no idea who she was calling. She was calling somebody else, obviously. And she was 6 years in AA. And we started talking, and we talked that whole day. And God knows, I don't remember any of the conversation, but I'll bet I did the most thorough fifth step in my whole life, you know? Because here's the deal with alcoholics. You know, it's, as I say, it's our brokenness. She told me about her. She didn't tell me about me. And I'd been to doctors, psychiatrists. I even went and talked to a priest once. And I told him I was going to talk to him as long as he didn't mention God. And he, bless his heart, didn't. He talked about alcoholism. I found out later, much, much later, many years later, that he was in the program. And he was just doing his part. But anyway, I talked to Robin, and that night she said, Rena, it's 7:30. We started talking around 7:30 this morning. That's 12 hours. If you go to sleep and sleep until 7:30 tomorrow morning, you will have 24 hours of sobriety, and that's how we do it in AA. And she said, and by the way, why don't you get on your knees and ask God for help to stay sober tonight? And I said, oh, Robin, I don't believe in God. She said, well, this is a spiritual program. And I said, I'm not spiritual. She said, well, then you lose. And that just scared me to death. And I said, maybe I'm a little spiritual. And you know, looking back at that, that's pretty cool, because that's that open-mindedness, that's that willingness I was talking about. I had just enough, not enough to make me comfortable, but just enough to get in the door. And she said, okay, in that case, if you're a little spiritual, here's what you do. Throw a shoe under the bed. While you're down there getting the damn shoe, say a few words. So I threw a shoe under the bed, got down on my knees, and I said, Robin's God, if there is a God, keep me sober tonight. Got the shoe out from under the bed as instructed and went to bed. And for the first night in forever, I slept like a baby. I had been sleeping those alcoholic sleeps where you jerk awake, you know, and I'm going through withdrawal. And that night I didn't do that. And I woke up the next morning and I had 24 hours. Man, I've got goosebumps thinking about it. It's just, I was so amazed. And I remember going outside, this was in Florida, and going outside and sitting down and thinking about, oh my God, all the problems I had, and how was I going to stay sober for this, and how was I going to stay sober for that. And I was thinking, I just don't know how I'm going to do this. And there was a little bird sitting on a tree. And I said, I tell you what, I'm going to give that little bird all these problems. And I gave that little bird all those problems. I was trying to think of it as a God thing, even though that was still so far from my experience. That little bird fell to the ground like it had been hit, and it walked off. And it had all my problems. I still cannot believe what happened to that little bird. But anyway, that little bird became my symbol, you know, a little robin. And whenever I see a robin, I say, thank you. And so I talked to Robin, obviously, and the man came back from, that went to the liquor store, and he knew I was really serious this time. I'd had those times, like we all do, of, I'm never going to drink again, never going to drink again. Never thought about, well, I'm not going to drink today. So anyway, she said, Rena, ordinarily we say, don't make any major decisions. You don't have to the first year. In this case, we're making an exception. He has got to go. Because he'd do things like he'd hide in a bush outside of an AA meeting and wait for me to come out and jump out. He thought I was looking for another man. And I mean, really, going to AA, looking for a man, I don't think so. Now keep in mind, I've had two AA husbands so far. Anyway, so I ended up, this is the one that I don't remember his name. I just know that he had taken my credit cards to go to the liquor store and had bought a few other things. So I had a bunch of bills because I was going to go get a little apartment, do whatever, and get sober. And I was desperate to be sober. I was willing to do whatever it took. And it's a good thing I felt that way because it took a lot. I ended up leaving him, and I had no money. I had to end up living with my father. My mother had died, as I said, and I ended up living with my father in Fort Lauderdale. We hated each other. You know, we were so alike. It was just looking back on it, we were so alike. And we never, ever had an adult conversation that we didn't end up shouting at each other and then slamming doors, and that's it. Well, since I was sober, I lived with him for 7 months, was able to make amends, was able to be helpful and useful to him. I remember asking him to go to a meeting with me one time. I told him it was because I wanted him to see what I was doing, but you know I had ulterior motives. And he said, oh no, he said, I don't want to go there and be that depressed. And I thought, of all the people laughing and having a great time and everything, he never went to an AA meeting. He thought that my husband that I met when I was 2 years sober got me sober. And that's all right, that's about him. You know, I had made my amends and we ended up having a pretty, as good a relationship as he would allow. And I've discovered that I have to do that with people. I can only get so close. I can get as close as they will let me. I don't try to push anymore. That has to do with sponsorship, by the way. So anyway, I lived with my father and started going to meetings, and ended up with a sponsor that was a very simple woman, but very strong in the program. She was strong in things like the slogans. She kept me on the slogans for the first couple of months because my head was so screwed up that I couldn't remember anything. I could remember easy does it when I couldn't tell you what the first step was. And I could remember let go and let God, which I by now fervently believed in because I was sober. That's how I came to believe in the second step. I came to believe because I stayed sober, and I knew I couldn't do that. Back then, I really knew I couldn't do it. When I was 40, I knew I couldn't do it. In between, sometimes yes, sometimes no. Sometimes I figured I'm doing it, you know, that this is me staying sober. I usually got my head handed to me on a plate when I was feeling like that. But anyway, so I stayed sober, and I did what they said to do. They said no dating the first year, and I said, oh, my God, I just came here to get sober. What are you talking about? And they said, that is what we're talking about. And now I know what they were talking about. You know, I easily distract. I can distract with books, with men, with booze, and I could have gone right back into distracting with a man. And my sponsor said something that hurt my feelings. She said, Rena, you are so sick. You're only going to attract a sick man. And, you know, I knew she was right. She was right. She said, you got to make yourself into a healthy woman to attract a healthy man. Okay, that's a nice goal. So I proceeded to do that. Anyway, when I was about 2 years sober, I met my husband, Bill, and we dated. We did not live together. We dated for 3 years and got married. And, man, I mean to tell you, I wish we'd lived together. All it worked out. Because as soon as we were in the same house, it was like every control issue we ever had came out. It was awful. It was game on, you know. And all of a sudden, everything he did annoyed me. You know, I have a friend that says, did he always breathe like that? And that's kind of the way it was with Bill. And of course, and my dear sponsor, by this time, I had a sponsor that I've had for 40 years. I just lost her last year. And I am still missing her and grieving something fierce. I'm sponsor hunting because I got to have a sponsor. I've got to be accountable. But Tommy said, Rena, I hear what you're saying about all this that he annoys you doing. What do you think you do that annoys him? Well, I hadn't looked at it like that. And she was very good at that sort of thing. She also, you know, took me through the steps the right way, right from the beginning. And I was 5 years sober at that point, so I was able to do a pretty good job, I thought. When I was 7 years sober, and Bill and I had gotten to the point where, with thank God for two sponsors and a therapist, we got it together, and we had a good relationship. But when I was seven, he was in a business where he traveled all the time, and I was alone, and I kind of got back into self-will run riot, and I started really exercising. Now, when I was a year sober, I decided to make amends to my body. I thought of what I had done for all those years, throwing booze in it, no food, you know, nothing. And so I got a book on nutrition, a book on vitamins, and I joined a gym. I'd never done anything physical in my life. You don't do much when you're reading, you know. And it's not exactly a physical exercise. And now it is. I can get on a treadmill and read. But anyway, so I did this. And, you know, I've been making amends to my body ever since. Somehow that took. There's only two things in my life that have really taken, because usually I get bored and want to go do something else. I've learned how to quilt. I made a bunch of good quilts. I don't do that anymore. You know, I do this, learn how to do it. I don't do it anymore. But with exercise, I still do it. I'm still as avid about keeping healthy. I decided in my 30s I was going to have a healthy old age, and so far, so good. You know, it's just part of the story that has nothing to do with me. I can't get it how my life, when I turn it over to the care of God, as it talks about in our book, I can look back and watch the guidance. I can't see it while I'm going through it, but I can sure see it afterwards. So Bill and I were married, and we ended up, I forgot, I wanted to tell you about this. I almost left AA when I was 7 years sober, because he was traveling. I was doing my exercise. I mean, I really got into exercise. I'd work out in the morning, work out in the evening, and meetings kind of went by the board. I went to one where with my sponsor because she would fire me if I didn't. And, you know, I was fear of sponsor kept me going down, you know, to Fort Lauderdale to be with Tommy. And looking on it now, I could see the judgments that came into my life. I know if I ever leave AA, it will be because I will reactivate the judgment machine. I started having opinions about people at meetings that were not good. I started having opinions about the way they wore their hair, about who said what, and oh my God, there he is again saying the same thing. And, you know, had judgments then about people driving and, you know, how the lines in the grocery store and all this stuff. And I had no clue. I was walking out of AA. And I still sponsored, which is obscene. And I was sitting with a woman telling her what to do, no doubt, and at Wendy's one day. And I happened to look up and saw the drive-thru window, and there was my sponsor. And she spent the summers in Connecticut, which is where she was from, and she was driving home early, about a month early. And all of a sudden, it overcame me, this fear of what I was doing, this awareness of what I was doing, the idea that I'm killing myself. And I didn't say a word to this poor woman. I got up and I ran out the door. Tommy had a convertible, and I ran and jumped in the side of the car and said, "Oh my God, I'm so glad to see you. I'm in deep trouble." And she, calm person as she is, she said, "Let's get together and talk about it." And we did. And I found out about how you can be sober for 7 years and still have total self-will run riot, though we usually don't think so. And I didn't even have a clue. I really thought everything was fine, you know, because I wasn't in active battle with Bill, you know, I wasn't in active battle with anybody. I was fine, and I looked great, you know. Anyway, and so we started over on the steps, and we did it from a whole new perspective of powerlessness. And one of my favorite lines in the big book is, "Alcohol is a subtle foe." And it is. It comes at me in ways that I don't recognize. It's disguised as something that seems perfectly normal. And I don't see it because I'm so self-centered that, you know, if I feel it, if I see it, if I think it, it must be right. And that was the scariest part of my whole sobriety when I realized what was happening. And that hasn't happened to that degree since then. But I've had to make a lot of surrenders, like all of us, like Bob, you know, like you, Shirley, you know, and Bo. All of us have had to make, in this room, have had to make surrenders, whether you're AA or Al-Anon. And when we moved up to Tennessee when I was 10, and 10 years sober, and Bill died on the golf course one afternoon when I was about 23, and he just had a massive heart attack. And all of a sudden, you know, there I am by myself, alone again, and I was terrified. But like you talked about, Bob, I was surrounded with love, the love of the AAs and the Al-Anons that I had gotten to know. Not just the women I sponsored, but everybody, men and women, came in. And just as soon as the word got out, they were at my house. And I told you I related to you. And it was a hard period, but you know what? Looking back on it, it was one of my most blessed, because I really found out where God lives. God lives in the moment. If I got ahead in the future, I was terrified. I don't know why. I'm perfectly capable of doing the day-to-day stuff of taking care of myself, but I was just terrified. If I got 1 minute in the past, I was in remorse. Thank God, Cole, that Bill and I had that day that he went out to play golf and I went to work out. I was doing it in a healthy manner, not overdoing it. And I went to work out, and we took a tour of my garden that I loved, and he said he loved me. I said I loved him, and we were going to meet for dinner, and that was going to be great. And But he left and died, and God surrounded him with people all in AA that played golf every Wednesday. They took care of everything. And they couldn't take care of my feelings, but they weren't supposed to. I was supposed to do that, me and God. And I still remember sitting in a closet with all his closet with all of his clothes, and I was so angry at him for leaving. He left me, he abandoned me, and I was so angry, and I was tearing those clothes off the hangers and throwing them on the ground and sticking them in bags. I was going to go get rid of them, get rid of every sign of him that ever was. And all of a sudden, I just stopped and started bawling. You know, this is not what I was really feeling. I was feeling deep loss. And I'd never felt that before. I think when I was feeling the loss with Bill, I was also feeling the loss of my brother, my sister, my mother, my father, and never had felt it before. All the grief incidents that had happened in my life, I was now feeling. It was the most healing time of my life. And I know you all do the same thing. When I'm in deep trouble like that, in the sense of sadness, is when I have the opportunity to get closer to my God and the opportunity to do more of a surrender to his will. And it works. You know, AA works, just in case you didn't know. Anyway, so I resume my life. Thank God for women. You know, the women that I sponsor have saved my life, because when I'm talking to them, I have to hear what I'm saying. They may not hear it. I don't know what they hear. But I know that what I'm saying, I know what I hear. And I started going to conventions a lot and meeting new people and having a ball. And it took me 2 years, seriously, to get out of shock. I was just so, it just shocked me. The suddenness of death is always presumably like that. And there was a man in AA that I'd known for 20 years, and he was a widower. And all of a sudden, I was at a meeting one time, and he looked different. And I started looking at him, he started looking at me, and we'll be celebrating 15 years of marriage later in May. And he jokes about it. He said, you know, I practiced on Bill so that I'd be perfect for him. Of course, he knew Bill. We all lived in Chattanooga and ended up moving down to Orange Beach and have the best life I can even imagine. I know that as I grow in the program, I get more and more out of the big book. Dirk knows I am a big book thumper par excellence. I never get tired of it. And the main reason I don't get tired of it is because they keep putting stuff in there when I'm not looking. They put new stuff in. And I just finished doing a big book workshop up in Ohio, where I learned about my continued dishonesty. And I found out that there's some things that I'm kind of worried about, and I think worrying is just a kind of a low-grade atheism. And I just don't quite trust God. Our humanity, you know, the stuff that keeps us together, our brokenness, our whatever else you want to call it, but our survivor instincts, and I think that's true for Al-Anon as well as AA, because we are survivors. I think that that's what keeps us here, keeps us growing. I will never forget the day that I sat down with Robin, the lady that called me by mistake, and she told me all about her. And that had never happened before. And that's why I am a big proponent of singleness of purpose. I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is for alcoholics. I did a little drugs too, but I don't talk about those. My main deal was alcohol. And I think that as long as we have that identification, which I felt with every one of you here that I've talked to this weekend, we relate right from the get-go. You know, I don't even have to know you, and I relate to you. And I think Al-Anons are just the flip side of an alcoholic in the same coin. You know, same feelings, same reactions, same everything. But I know that as long as I stick with the program and give up being the world's policeman and stop judging, you know, because you know that old thing about if you point your finger at somebody else, there's three pointing back at you. This is not for newcomers, people. This is for people like me and all of you in this room, you know. But today I am happy, joyous, and free. I love my life. It is not without fault, and I know that, and that's good because it keeps me growing. I cannot believe how happy I am to have been here. I have learned so much from all of you that I've talked to. I look forward. I can't be here in the fall, but I certainly am planning on bringing a carload of ladies up in the spring, because you all have something here that's really special. It really is, and I know how hard it is to put one of these together. I've been a participant in several workshops like this that I know the hard work, and I am a most grateful recipient of all your hard work. And thank you for listening.